Yeah. Power Rangers.
One of them.
One of them, yeah. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Sonia.
Talthea.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is also syndicated, and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. The Electronic Intifada produced another podcast titled It's Easy to Say Black Lives Matter. It is a discussion on Black Palestinian solidarity in the context of the current U.S. uprisings against police violence and what it means to internationalize liberation struggles. It features Christian Davis Bailey, co-founder of Black for Palestine, and Ajamu Baraka, scholar, writer, former Green Party vice presidential candidate, an editor with the Black Agenda Report, and the national organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace. In this podcast, you will also hear Noura Burrows-Friedman and Issa Winstanley, co-hosts of the Electronic Intifada podcast, discuss this global moment with revolutionary potential and some of their recent articles. Let's listen in to It's Easy to Say Black Lives Matter podcast from the Electronic Intifada.
It's about this neoliberal capitalist order. It's about colonialism. It's about colonized people in the U.S. who are rising up, if you will, against their colonizers. So that connection between our struggles and specifically the struggles against the settler colonial state of Israel is quite clear.
But if we can shift solidarity in that direction to a point of material joint struggle, of learning about each other's histories and what worked and what didn't work, and trying to address the colonial question, we could literally have the whole world afire.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm your host, Noura Burrows-Friedman, and my co-host, Asa Winstanley in London. Asa, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good, Noura. I hope you're doing well, even with the global pandemic still happening.
It's still
sort of going on. And I don't know, it feels like we are in sort of a global moment with revolutionary potential. It feels like there's lots of different currents and trends all sort of flowing together and clashing in one particular moment, which could dissipate and it could just sort of be pushed back and fade out as others have. But it could, I mean, I always think the revolution's coming, right? So like, I'm always disappointed. But I don't know, this one feels a little bit different, right? I don't know, what do you think?
It does. Yeah, I think there's a huge convergence right now of so many different factors. You know, the pandemic, the tipping point for the way that that policing has been viewed in this country. I think so many people are finally, even though, you know, especially as Black people in the U.S. and in Europe have been struggling against state violence for hundreds of years. I feel like the mainstream is now finally at a level of like actually recognizing the inherent systemic institutionalized violence that the police are, that, you know, they've been set up that way, and this is how the system works. So yeah, and then here in the U.S., you know, compound those two things, the pandemic and the Black struggle for liberation, with you know, millions and millions of people unemployed,
mass unemployment, you know, and mass sort of people being trapped inside during the pandemic has been like a major factor of why people have been able to come out on the streets, I think.
That's right.
And it has the beginnings, or like the kernel of like a genuinely global movement. And it's not, the thing is, it's not only a solidarity movement, not to denigrate solidarity movements in any way, but it's not like people, Black people and their sympathizers, their allies, however you want to phrase that, in countries like especially Britain, France, these, you know, these centers of former colonial and imperial power, with large you know, so-called ethnic minority communities, Black people, brown people, you know, who are in many instances the descendants of the inhabitants of former colonies of these imperial centers, are demonstrating for their own rights. They're not just demonstrating for, again, not to denigrate any form of solidarity, because solidarity and global solidarity is important, of course, as you know, as we know, and as the center of what we do at EI. But it is of course, like Black people in London and Paris are demonstrating, yes, in sympathy with George Floyd and the family of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and, you know, all these names on and on and on through the years, the last few years of Black people just being murdered in the street. They are, you know, it is sympathy and solidarity, but they recognize their own plight, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so, right. So it's not, you know, so for example, police in London, there's less guns, right? So Black people are less likely to be shot down. Police don't regularly carry guns, but the police are no less brutal, you know. Right. It means that Black people get killed by being beaten, you know. And there is still police with guns, and they have tasers and so forth. But, you know, I just was seeing a new report came out today that a certain police force in the West Midlands, where there is relatively large Black population, Black people are four times as likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people. You know, and there's just these stark realities of how things are in our imperial countries, has really led to this kind of global movement. And I think that we're seeing a kind of, like you said, like this kind of mass awareness and rising of consciousness. One of the things I think has been a little bit different from the last phase of Black Lives Matter, when it first started in 2014-15, has been that in some areas, these protests have been mostly white. Like the statue, the beautiful moment when the statue of the slave trader Colston, when it was toppled the other week, most of the protesters were white, you know, and that's the result of long. It wasn't just a spontaneous moment, although there was, you know, it was that too. But there was a lot. There's years, literally years of struggle behind the removal of that statue, you know, and none of it worked.
Right, and
removing it by direct action work and dumping it in the docks, that was brilliant.
Yeah, it was quickly resolved by anti-fascist, you know, anti-racist activists. A years-long debate of whether or not to, you know, pull down this statue and whatever. That debate wasn't necessary anymore.
Yeah,
and I think that spirit, you know, and of course, you know, the Confederate statues all over the U.S. have been pulled down. There have been beheadings of Columbus, you know, Christopher Columbus statues around the U.S. as well. That's a great start, you know, as Ajamu Baraka was telling us before we recorded our interview, which we'll go to in a few minutes. You know, what about all of the so-called founding fathers of the U.S. Who are revered still, you know, by the liberal class, who were enslaving people themselves and committing genocides against indigenous people here on this continent at the same time. And, you know, so we have still obviously a long way to go, but this spirit is pretty indomitable right now.
And we have the similar issue in the UK as well, with the removal of Robert Colston, who is just this, who I think most people in the UK had never heard of before. I mean, I hadn't heard of him. Although friends in Bristol tell me that about this campaign that has been going on for a long, long time. And it's not just one statue. Like, there's a school named after him, and they were going to name a shopping centre after him, a mall. And there was a big campaign, and they were forced to
retreat. That's pretty on the nose.
I mean, it's crazy, yeah. Right? I mean, that was just a few years ago. The point is that this is a pretty unambiguous monster, right? Like, he was a slave. He was a slave trader, you know. And there was no, you know, it's kind of easier to make that case. But then there's the issue of people like Winston Churchill, who is a widely regarded national figure in the UK, who has this kind of aura of invincibility around him, but actually was. Although he came after the era of slavery, if he'd been born only a hundred or so years earlier, there's no doubt that he would have been a slave trader. He's just from that class, and he was quite openly racist and anti-Semitic against, you know, so-called lesser races, as he founded it. And one of his most notorious racist statements about not admitting that the dog in the manger has any right to the manger was in defense of Zionism, which was quite a telling thing. You know, he said that he did not admit that any great wrong had been done to the quote unquote red Indians and the black aboriginals of Australia because a superior race had come along to supplant them. And he was saying the same thing, that white European Jews were coming along to supplant the Palestinians, and that therefore they were a superior race and they deserved to be supplanted. That's how he thought, you know. So we need to, this is, you know, it's in a similar way to these conversations about the founding fathers in the US. I think quite often in this country, in the UK, we like to think, oh, well, you know, things aren't as bad as in America, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, as has been pointed out, like, the foundation of American white supremacy comes from the British Empire, you know?
Yeah, it's quite a moment right now. And I'm both very excited and also really fearful about the blowback by these imperial states on people and on marginalized and vulnerable communities. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, doing Palestine work for all of these years, we see the everyday effects of settler colonial imperial powers on a subjugated and confined population. And the shared values that Israel has with the US and the UK and all of these other imperial forces around the world only kind of highlights the necessity of moving this kind of movement forward for liberation for everyone. So before we go to the interview, this fantastic interview that we're really proud to bring you with Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace, former vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, and Christian Davis Bailey, who's the co-founder of Black for Palestine. I wanted to just ask you to update us, Asa, on the last couple of stories that you wrote for the Electronic Intifada about the new UK ambassador to Israel, or Israel's ambassador to the UK. And
it's confusing. Like you never quite know which way around they go.
Exactly.
Right? There's this big crossover.
You're right.
Especially
exactly.
with the US ambassador at the moment.
I mean, David Friedman, no relation, by the way. Not related, as far as I know. Right. He's officially the US's ambassador to Israel, but he definitely acts like he's the other way around. I mean, right. He's actually a settler, right? Like he has stake in settlements in the occupied West Bank. You exposed this other Israeli official, Zipi Hotov Eli. So tell us about both Gilad Erdan and this new Hotov Eli character that we're seeing pop up in official positions now.
Right. So I think, unlike Friedman, I don't think there's going to be this ambiguity there with Zipi Hotov Eli. Like, she's a real hardcore right wing pro settler minister from the Likud party. So she's she's basically the hard right of the Likud party, and she is being sent to. It was recently announced that she is going to be the next Israeli ambassador to the UK, and she will replace Mark Regev probably at some point in this summer. But it's a bit uncertain at the moment exactly when. So she's for years she's been one of the leaders of the so-called sovereignty movement. So the hardcore West Bank Israeli settlers have been arguing for what they call sovereignty to be applied over the whole of the West Bank. And so essentially what that means is that she and her friends have been calling for the remaining 22% of historical Palestine to be formally annexed to the State of Israel, but with no rights for Palestinians who live in that 22%, only rights for the Jews who live in that 22%. So it would be, you know, a further formal entrenchment of formal apartheid under, you know, Israeli domination and a form of sort of Jewish supremacy in historical Palestine. So she's quite, you know, for the last few years she's been in the deputy foreign minister, which at certain periods has meant she's been de facto the foreign minister of Israel, because, you know, the foreign minister was Netanyahu, who at certain points he was the prime minister, was also the foreign minister at the same time. Right. So she's had quite a lot of power, and it's kind of she's kind of flown under the radar a little bit. Like, you know, she made a few waves when she entered the foreign ministry in 2015. She said she made a speech to the Israeli civil servants saying, "This land is ours, all of it." And we did not come to apologize for that. And she invoked religious texts. And she is, by the way, she's also she's a religious Zionist as well. So she's, I spent a week or so watching all of her English language YouTube videos on her channel, which she seems quite proud of. And there's some really hardcore racist stuff there. And she invokes biblical texts, you know, biblical mythology, to say that this is the basis of our right to this land. So she says, like, King David established his kingdom here in Hebron, so therefore only Jews have a right to it. And, you know, our father Abraham came here, and therefore that's our right. So this kind of sort of extremism is the reason why even some Zionists have opposed her appointment as the ambassador to the UK, not because they disagree with anything she's saying, but because they think she will be bad for their image. And, you know, hopefully they're right about that, and she will be bad for their image. But you know, I'm not so sure. Like, Israel gets carte blanche, and I think Netanyahu knows that. You know, he gets carte blanche from the European governments, the EU, and worse than carte blanche, they get rewarded. Israel gets constantly rewarded for their crimes.
No matter how bad their image is. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I don't think these Zionists in the UK really have that much to worry about. Yeah, so like one of the people who objected to her purely on PR grounds was Melanie Phillips, who's this awful... I mean, she's a real hardcore racist herself. Like, she's a British columnist in The Times, you know, the right-wing Tory paper, mainstream Tory paper. And she's just like the most openly Islamophobic, pro-Zionist... racist columnist. I mean, even in the UK, she's regarded as a bit of a crackpot to a certain extent, but she has this mainstream platform. Even Melanie Phillips said, well, this is a bad idea because she's a bit much, basically. She said, oh, she sounds like a blustering zealot to British ears. I mean, whatever. This is another thing Melanie Phillips obsessed with. She's a real headbanger, and so it will be like it will be a sort of contrast to Mark Regev, who, you know, for all his extremism and racism, had a way, like, he was a skilled propagandist, I suppose we could say, in a way that I don't think she is. So it'll be interesting to see how it develops. And also, the last thing to say about her, I suppose, is that she has been, after all these years of promoting the settler movement as an activist and as a politician, a low-level lawmaker, and then later a minister, she's now been put in charge of a new Israeli ministry, the Settlements Ministry, which will be, you know, is being touted to lead the plan to annex the West Bank. So what she was calling for all those years, she's now been put in charge of implementing, or at least setting up the ministry that will implement it. So... we'll see.
Well, thanks for doing all of that research. I know it probably wasn't easy watching all of her YouTube videos.
Yeah, you know.
Yikes.
I don't know. It's part of the job.
We do it so you don't have to, listeners, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I kind of enjoyed it because it was like, I don't know. It's like this way that we have to get scoops, Nora, like, kind of know no one else is going to do this, so it's like, yeah, can get this story. Right.
Yeah. Amazing. And before we head to the interview, just quickly tell us an update on Gilad Erdan's employment. He, of course, has been the head of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which has been tasked with attempting to destroy the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns around the world. Tell us about Gilad Erdan's new job.
Right, so, I mean, this is another interesting development, which does relate to Zippy Hotaveli. So Gilad Erdan has now been... he's concluded his time as the Minister for Strategic Affairs, the anti-BDS minister. And he is also being shipped abroad to be the Israeli ambassador to the US and to the UN at the same time, right?
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see where this develops. I mean, I think part of this, of both of these stories, is kind of internal... Likud politicking. It's Netanyahu sort of politicking, because Zippy Hotaveli was personally recruited more than a decade ago by Netanyahu, and he was kind of groomed and raised up. And Gilad Erdan is also perceived to be close to Benjamin Netanyahu, And so they're probably, I know certainly Gilad Erdan, but probably, I mean, I haven't seen this touted, but after watching her videos, I could see her as a future Prime Minister of Israel. You know, she's this extreme right. She's really a Kahanist, is what she is, without the name. Kahanist without Kahani himself. Kahanist in everything but name. I could definitely see her as a future Prime Minister of Israel. So they're both probably perceived to be rivals in a way, potential rivals to Netanyahu. And you know, they've both been, as far as I know, they've both been incredibly loyal to him up until now. But you know, it's probably always on Netanyahu's mind that they could position themselves further to the right and outmaneuver him in some way for power potentially in the future. I don't know. So probably shipping them both overseas it could be a way for him to remove them, right? But also it could be maybe he's grooming them more. I don't know. Like it could be. I'm speculating a bit here, but it could be like, well, train overseas for a bit, and then maybe in the future we can see. Or maybe it's both. You know, maybe he's saying that to them, but on the other hand, thinking, well, I get you out of the way, kind of thing. But yeah, we'll see.
Wow. Well, yeah, we'll be watching both of those ambassadors very carefully, obviously, here on the Electronic Intifada. Asa, thank you so much for diving into that for us. And let's go to the interview with Ajamu Baraka and Christian Davis Bailey to talk about the U.S. uprisings and internationalizing the struggle of these liberation movements from the U.S. to Palestine.
Struggle in our spirit, we all go down. Fight the hatred and oppression, we all go down. Take the power of the higher self, we all go down. Do with our pride, just a fire in our eyes. We don't need no water, let the mother burn.
We're delighted to be joined by Ajamu Baraka and Christian Davis Bailey to talk about the U.S. uprisings and Black Palestinian solidarity at this moment. Ajamu Baraka is a longtime human rights activist, scholar, and writer. He's an editor with the Black Agenda Report and is the national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamu is also the former vice presidential candidate with the U.S. Green Party. Christian Davis Bailey is a writer, activist, and the co-founder of Black for Palestine. He'll also be publishing a brand new op-ed on Palestinian advocacy and support for the Black struggle here on the Electronic Intifada. Ajamu and Christian, it's so good to have you both with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you.
It is so good to be here. Thank you so much.
So Ajamu, let's start with you, having you outline this current moment across the U.S. and across the world as people demonstrate and rise up against centuries of unabated police violence and what this has to do with the international struggle against the police state. What are your thoughts as you see what's unfolding around the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting phenomenon. You know, the people came to the streets because, of course, the trigger was the slow videotape execution of George Floyd. And the target was the police state and policing in the U.S. And there was legitimate anger expressed. But you know what? It started to seem to me that the George Floyd situation was almost like a metaphor for the pent-up anger, frustration, and recognition on the part of so many millions in the U.S. To the notion that none of our lives really mattered. And so, I mean, this came on the heels of, and in the midst, if you will, of this ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and the quite clear messaging from the ruling class in the U.S. That they were more concerned with the economy and profit-making than the lives and health of the people. And I think people felt that. So, you know, for me, the uprising is an uprising against policing, but it is slowly, I think, pivoting to an uprising against neoliberal dehumanization. And I think that people around the world are sort of making that connection, that and have that understanding even more so than we do in the U.S. I think that pivot is happening. But I think when I was doing press a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, it was quite clear to me that people understood that it wasn't just about George Floyd. It wasn't just about policing in the U.S. It wasn't just about something called justice. It was something bigger than that. It was about the colonial system. It was about the structure of international capitalism. It was a cry against generalized dehumanization.
Yeah, Christian, you've been thinking about this a lot as well. Your work with Black for Palestine focuses on making these connections, not just in an ideological or theoretical sense, but real, tangible connections for joint struggle against colonialism and state violence. Tell us about your work and how you see this moment as, a flashpoint for transformation and growth of these liberation movements.
Yeah, so, I've been stuck the last few weeks trying to figure out how this moment is different from 6 years ago or 7 years ago when Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown were killed, when we saw the uprising in Ferguson, the emergence of this, quote, Black Lives Matter moment. And this was even the moment in which Black for Palestine developed, and we saw a resurgence in the generations old story of Black and Palestinian solidarity and joint struggle. As Ajahn was already said, I think this moment is interesting because around the world we've seen a rightward shift even over the past 4 or 5 years. And so to have these protests for racial justice in the context of the pandemic and states failing us across the board, it's been really inspiring to see how specifically the Black and African diasporas have been rising up and burning down police stations, tearing down statues of slave owners and colonizers. We saw people in Brussels deface the statue of King Leopold, who committed one of the worst genocides in European history in the Congo. So I'm heartened by this moment, and also it just brings a lot of questions. I think this moment, a little bit more than 2014, has a crystal clear focus on the Black struggle and Black issues. In 2014, during the Ferguson uprising, we also had the last war on Gaza. And so there was kind of a concurrent conversation about Palestine, Palestinian liberation, and Black liberation. But just based on the just messages, requests for updates, questions about how both Palestinians and solidarity activists can better support the Black struggle in this moment, there is a difference in that the focus is on Black liberation, and we're dealing with questions of how do we move beyond just rhetorical statements of solidarity or hashtag Black Lives Matter to tangible support for our community and our struggle.
What does that look like? What, you know, you mentioned the Ferguson protests in 2014. We saw Palestinian activists sending their like best practices for how to deal with tear gas, because it is literally the same tear gas that was being fired upon protesters in Ferguson that Palestinians are subjected to by Israeli state forces. What does that tangible solidarity look like right now?
Yeah, I think, and I speak to some of this in the article that will appear later in EI, but there's many practical ways to tangibly invest in Black liberation, and it largely centers around actually building relationships with grassroots organizers and organizations wherever you are, but also in the flashpoints of Black struggle, cities like Detroit or places like Jackson, Mississippi, where there's an entire movement for Black self-determination. So to me, I think what material solidarity looks like is what people are already practicing in the context of Palestine. There's hundreds of people who spend thousands of dollars a year to go visit the West Bank, to to meet with organizers, to volunteer to help farmers harvest olives and defend the land from settlers, or to try to defend Palestinians from being evicted or having their homes demolished. People can invest that same time, energy, and money into meeting with, building relationships with, and learning from Black communities and Black organizers. And I think, I mean, so for some people, this conversation around Black and Palestinian solidarity is their primary engagement with the Black struggle. Or groups like Black for Palestine or Black Alliance for Peace are just the main kind of touch points people have with the Black movement. I think what this moment requires is moving beyond the groups that are already kind of in direct solidarity with Palestine to supporting people. You know, there's any number of projects. Like in Detroit, for example, there's plenty of movements for Black food security and self-determination in terms of being able to produce food to feed the community, or having sovereignty over land in the face of gentrification. To me, supporting Palestine is supporting Black and Indigenous people fighting for self-determination on this territory. And I think what I'm saying here is I'd like to see a shift specifically among Palestinian Americans and the solidarity movement to just more intensified and direct solidarity on the ground here in the so-called United States.
Both of you, could you perhaps talk about what it's been like to see international solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement in the US, and not just Palestine, but I mean, you know, we've seen protests all over the world, really. So what is the meaning of this? Like you've alluded to it somewhat in talking about Christian, the spread of these demonstrations and so forth, but and why is it and how it's been different from 2014, 2015, but why did it spread so rapidly to these, you know, centers of former imperial power?
Well, if I could jump in for a second, I would say that I mean, that's a very, very interesting question, and I think it's related to what Christian said a moment ago in terms of the tenor of the times and what has changed even from 2014. I would even suggest that the period that this reminds me of the most has to be the late 1960s. When there was these kinds of expressions of solidarity among and between the Black liberation movement in the U.S. Struggles for liberation, anti-capitalist struggles globally, what might be a little different is that the politics may have been a little bit sharper in terms of it was quite clear and people understood that there was a revolutionary process unfolding in the U.S. And that Black folks, African people, were at the center of that process, and that we saw ourselves as part of a global anti-colonial, anti-capitalist movement. And so it's important that in this moment, as people are standing up and standing in solidarity with what they see in the U.S., that we try to sharpen the politics so that the same kind of understanding that was present in 1968 might be present today. And what I mean by that is this. We're not struggling for integration, at least not some of us. We're not struggling to win something called justice for some of us. We see ourselves as part of a revolutionary process connected to all of the colonized people of the planet who are engaged in resolute, ferocious opposition to this U.S., EU, NATO axis of domination, to the pan-European white supremacist, colonial, capitalist patriarchy. That project is the project that represents the enemy of all people. And therefore, you know, our struggles in the U.S. Needs to be seen in that way. That is not about us wanting to be a good, quote-unquote, Americans, but that this is an expression, a redeveloping expression of that revolutionary spirit. And that's why the state is so desperate to make sure that that pivot that I talked about earlier does not occur, that they keep it at the level of something called racial justice and even Black Lives Matter, as opposed to that that pivot taking place and people understanding that it's about this neoliberal capitalist order. It's about the, it's about colonialism. It's about colonized people in the U.S. Who are rising up, if you will, against their colonizers. So that connection between our struggles and specifically the struggles against the settler colonial state of Israel is quite clear. That's why the work that Christian and those and folks have been so incredibly important in helping people to understand those connections, using that as an entry point for developing that kind of anti-colonial consciousness.
I mean, another question I often ask myself is how close are we to a 1968 type moment? And so, Jamu, I hope that we get to that point as soon as we can. And agree that there's a lot of work that needs to happen before that. But I'm wondering if one of the reasons there's so many demonstrations specifically across colonized diasporas in Europe right now is that the 68 moment was a moment of global quote-unquote decolonization, or at least anti-colonial movement. And it's been over 50 years in some cases for decolonization. And so many of us are now realizing that, well, the formal colonialism ended, but our home countries and our diasporas are still suffering under colonialism, under racial capitalism, under neoliberalism. And so my hope for this moment is that those politics crystallize across borders in a more serious way. But I think for us in the U.S. and specifically within the movement for Black Lives or whatever you want to call this moment, we really have to sharpen our politics around internationalism to understand that it's not just an issue of achieving quote-unquote justice here, and that even if somehow we're successful in defunding the police and abolishing police and prisons, that the U.S. military is to the rest of the world what the police are to Black, Indigenous, and working class populations in the United States. So on a mass scale in terms of organizing, we need to see more calls for defunding the military at the same time as we're calling for defunding the police.
Right. Right. And what we're also seeing, you know, especially in social media right now, is like a new wave of nostalgia for the Obama years. Ajamu, your work and all of our comrades at the Black Agenda Report has always been a powerful force against that kind of nostalgia. People in Palestine remember what Obama did for Israel. People in Afghanistan remember what he did to them. Can you talk about what it looks like to push back on this neoliberal nostalgia, why it's important, as much as we detest Trump, to not give former administrations a pass right now when we're talking about reimagining what community safety and security means at this moment.
Well, it's critically important to point to the Obama administration in a very critical way, because to do otherwise would be to prop up ideologically the notion that liberals and the neoliberal right represented a real difference between the more extremist right that's not in power, represented by the Trump forces, although that may be controversial, what I just said. But You know, we want people to understand that the oppression that people experience in the U.S. Is an oppression that is administered by a duopoly. Both of these parties represent the same objective class interests in general, and that for us to pursue a politics that plays right into the hands of the neoliberal right by suggesting that there's some kind of fundamental difference between the neoliberal right represented by Biden and the Trump forces, to us is a disservice. It does not represent the objective interests or perspectives of oppressed, colonized African people in the U.S. Because we say, we take the position that on the day after the election in this country in November, it does not really matter who is sitting in the white people's house. Nothing objectively changes for us because we would not have dismantled the oppressive colonial system. So, you know, we have to engage in that kind of ideological struggle because we do have some very powerful liberal forces that want us to want to control the narrative, want to make it a struggle for racial, so-called racial justice. They want to disconnect it from the internationalist perspective, the understanding that this is part of a world system. They want to domesticate it and colonize it. So we have to constantly remind people of the backwardness, the criminality of the Obama administration, because that administration did more than any other administration to completely confuse people, and black people in particular, and really consolidated a right-wing tendency among African people that we are having to contend with to today.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how Zionist and Israel lobby organizations are co-opting this moment right now. The Anti-Defamation League, you know, sent out a statement, you know, supposedly saying that Black Lives Matter. AIPAC did last week. The very right wing Zionist so-called feminist group Zioness put out a 5-page statement using the language of this moment to basically shill for Israel and talk about how if you support the movement for Black Lives that you must also support Israel. What are both of your thoughts on the way that these right wing pro-colonialist organizations are trying to, you know, as Jamu, you just said, as to try and confuse people even more?
Yeah. So I want to push back on one thing. I don't think they are co-opting solidarity. I think they're trying to, but it's really apparent that if you support Zionist supremacy and colonization and racism and murder of Palestinians, there's no way you can be in solidarity with our struggle and our issues as Black people. And specifically as someone who is a Black anti-Zionist, I have been attacked by many of these organizations or representatives of them. So it's very clear, both now and in the past, that there's a kind of conditional solidarity with the Black struggle. Like we saw the picture of like Black radicals and revolutionaries versus the civil rights tendency and who supported Palestine and who supported Israel. But we know that groups like SNCC were viciously attacked for taking explicitly anti-Zionist and anti-colonial positions. That it's hard to kind of quantify what role this had in the dissolution of the organization, but it definitely contributed to one of the most powerful like groups and tendencies of the 60s moment to falling out of power and existence. So that needs to be like stated and very clear when we talk about the legacy of Zionist attacks on Black liberation organizers.
I have a question about the Israel Lobby USA, the film, the Al Jazeera film. I don't know if either of you or both of you saw the film, Lobby USA. Just to, for listeners who might not have seen it, the undercover investigation by Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera's investigative unit, infiltrated one of their reporters into the Israel Project, a now defunct Israel lobby group in the US, and he went along to a conference which was attended by Israeli diplomats, and one of them was in the Israeli Consul General in Atlanta, Georgia, and she talked about the, and this was 2016, so she was talking about Black Lives Matter as a problem for them, and this was, it must have been soon after the Movement for Black Lives adopted a pro-BDS platform, a platform which included planks in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. And she said, quote, "The major problem with Israel is the young generation of the black community. Black Lives Matter starts there." So it's interesting how I suppose that their rhetoric has kind of, not rhetoric, perhaps their strategy has moved on a bit to, as was stated, attempted co-optation, at least adopting of the language. But it, in this kind of private setting, actually referring to it as a problem. So, Christian, I think I saw you nod in there that you'd seen the film. So perhaps you could talk about it a bit. What you made of that footage?
Yeah, I'm not sure what I have to add beyond. I think that period in 2016, not only did the Movement for Black Lives endorse BDS, they also stated that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians. And is an apartheid state. And the combination of those three things brought a lot of backlash against the movement. Like, I remember, I think there was supposed to be a fundraiser benefit for the movement in Broadway, somewhere in Broadway, that was canceled, or the venue took back the access to the space based on their position around Palestine. And I'm sure there's plenty of more private instances of that happening that we're not aware of. So I think in calling Black Lives Matter a strategic threat, which may have been challenged by some groups, but I don't think that's the general kind of position of Zionist groups. You can't call a movement a strategic threat and then be in solidarity with it. And so that's like the dissonance that I just think it's not going to work on their end.
Yeah, I think that's part of the issue, though, is that I think that they are probably very much I think they are monitoring very closely developments within the broader sort of Black Lives Matter movement to see to what extent the stated opposition to Zionism and support for Palestinians would translate into concrete and sustained actions. And I suspect that they concluded tactically they didn't need to move more aggressively on that element because the work didn't really crystallize. So then they can fall back to Plan B by, you know, giving lip service like everybody else to this notion of Black Lives Matter and why they continue to monitor to make sure that that pivot to a more aggressive support for Palestinian liberation does not occur. I mean, they have still, you know, they still are bringing people into so-called Israel proper on trips. They're still cultivating a young black leadership. They're still watching very closely Christian. I mean, you know, they're very much concerned about that pivot taking place. So, you know, it is an interesting kind of phenomenon, but it's connected to what we've been talking about, that it's easy to say Black Lives Matter, it's easy to talk about you all for racial justice. I mean, everybody in the U.S. from the chiefs of staffs of the U.S. military to Lindsey Graham has said that they are for so-called racial justice. But it's another thing when you start really challenging the system, and it's another thing when you start reminding them of their support for Palestine, reminding them of their silence to the slaughter that took place in Gaza, reminding them that it's the U.S. and the Obama administration responsible for the slaughter in Yemen, reminding them of their silence when the U.S. and NATO attacked Libya, which was an attack on the African continent. You know, so, you know, when the politics sharpen, and they will, then many of the people who pretend to be allies today will not only fall to the side, but they will go into, I think, aggressive opposition.
Yeah, I mean, that's my hope for the crystallization of a global anti-colonial political project and movement right now. Is that if we can raise the collective consciousness and general baseline of struggle and demands to the level of we are colonized people still fighting against a system that is exploiting and oppressing us, it becomes much harder for what the ADL or Zionist groups are doing and trying to co-opt solidarity. But I think as part of that, or what I hope emerges from that, even on the level of Palestine, is a pivot away from European and white supremacist states and organizations like the EU, Congress, the UN, towards countries who have experienced colonialism, like literally the entire continent of Africa that is bordering Palestine, or us as Black and Indigenous folks in the belly of the imperial beast. But if we can shift solidarity in that direction to a point of material joint struggle, of learning about each other's histories and what worked and what didn't work in trying to address the colonial question, we could literally have the whole world afire at the same time in the same way that we saw in the 60s. And that's what's actually going to give us the wins that we need to experience freedom and liberation.
That's the voice of Christian Davis Bailey. He is a writer, activist, and the co-founder of Black for Palestine. His new op-ed is going to be on the Electronic Intifada, so check that out when it is published, and we'll also add a link to it when it's up here on the Electronic Intifada podcast blog post. And Ajamu Baraka, he's a human rights activist, scholar, writer, editor with the Black Agenda Report, and national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace. And you can find him on Twitter at Ajamu Baraka. Also, your website, Ajamu, is ajamubaraka.com. And, of course, blackforpalestine.com. Ajamu Baraka, Christian Davis Bailey, thank you so much for being with us and for all the work that you do.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Really happy to speak with you. Thank you.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
That was a podcast titled It's Easy to Say Black Lives Matter, produced by the Electronic Intifada. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, Peace on Earth.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.